Vision 7 Radio Network welcomes Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes, heard every Monday at 11 a.m. and 11 p.m. Eastern Time. Using nearly 200 years of abundant and consistent afterlife evidence, quantum physics, consciousness research, and ancient writings, we seek to understand who and what we are, how reality works, the nature of God, and the meaning and purpose of our lives. Join Roberta weekly to better understand our one reality and gain insights into how we can make the most of the glorious eternal beings that we are.
Welcome to Seek Reality with your host, Roberta Grimes. Author and attorney Roberta Grimes will explore and illustrate how she, after an extraordinary experience of light in childhood, has discovered channels of communication to the afterlife and how these implications have an effect on our everyday lives. Please welcome the host of Seek Reality, Roberta Grimes.
Dear friends, welcome to Seek Reality. I'm Roberta Grimes, and I'm so glad you can be with us today. If you and I have been friends for a while, you may think of me as a science basher, and you would be right. The fact that the mainstream scientific gatekeepers, the university departments, and the peer-reviewed journals have for more than a century maintained materialism, it was what they used to call the fundamental scientific dogma. They're too embarrassed now to say those words. Has for more than a century kept us from really getting scientific investigation of the truth. They didn't want to look at the building evidence that human minds are eternal, and that's been stupid, but the most important artifact of that is the fact that essentially science has been off the rails for 100 years. They're going to have to repeat all that work once they accept reality. They, especially in looking at things like out-of-body travel and near-death experiences, they've limited their inquiries to trying to find some reported aspect of the offered phenomenon, and they then would try to replicate it in the laboratory, and then the ways they would do it were often laughable, but then they would say, well, look, we have repeated that single phenomenon, which means that the whole area of inquiry, near-death experiences, out-of-body travel, has been debunked. What they would say is this simply isn't real. But this is basically a dishonest way to use science to try to beat back the truth. So at this point, I am not much of a fan of science or of scientists, but there are some open-minded people in the scientific field, and a few of them I really love. Our guest this week is my favorite non-scientist. His name is Ira Pastor, and he is a fascinating man. He's the CEO of BioQuark Incorporated, hope I say that right, Ira, a company that works in the regenerative medicine side of the biotech industry. And for the last few years, he's been involved in the dynamics of central nervous system regeneration, studying both human and non-human species, and he's been doing a lot of other stuff. Ira is not a scientist in a traditional sense, but he has the curiosity of a child, he has the vision of a keen research scientist, and he has the kind of open mind and heart that you really never see in anyone. This is a wonderful man. Welcome, Ira. I'm so glad you're finally with us.
Hi, Roberta. Thanks for having me. I'm so excited after all these years of talking, communicating, that we're finally getting together like this. This is exciting.
He first reached out, we figured out, 4 years ago to me, and I sent him some things, he sent me some things, and then he would tell me what he was experimenting with. I would tell him from the viewpoint of what I had learned why it wouldn't work, he would do it anyway. But he always, we've had such a wonderful friendship just by email that it's finally delightful to be able to have a conversation. Ira, tell us how you first became interested in exploring like the edges of our scientific understanding of the mind. How did you start this?
Well, as you said, I'm a child at heart. I always have been. And even though, I can give you the more traditional background, that I was a son of a pharmacist here in the Philadelphia area, and I grew up around medicines. I went to pharmacy school and business school and spent my time hanging around the pharmaceutical industry. That's not really what did it. It was, as I've said before on other shows, I loved comic books. I loved science fiction. And it was just the type, that I maintained a childish enthusiasm for creating or exploring the bleeding edges of possibility. And, you know, till this day, I have three children of my own. And they, you know, they kind of look at me like a geek. Dad, why do you want to go to all these these superhero films? And why are you still reading comic books in your office?
Comic books? Why does that not surprise me, Ira? It really doesn't. I think that's great. Where did BioQuark come from? Because you're its CEO. Did you found it or did you co-found it?
I co-founded it. I was one of its early investors, and it was, BioQuark's mission is all about going back to nature and exploring sort of the second level of biological dynamics that, you know, we've studied for hundreds of years in terms of regeneration and repair and rejuvenation of whole organisms, whether that, you know, limbs of newts or, you know, the ability to cut a starfish in half and get two of them. The first 100 years of the industry was heavily based on natural products, specifically from plant, bacteria, and fungal communities. But, you know, we sort of never went beyond that because just, you know, the overly reductionist way of studying things, you know, killing to understand life and so forth, doesn't allow you to really, you know, talk, in a sense, to the salamander, to the newt, to the starfish, and understand, you know, what's going on when we chop this thing in half and you create two of them. So it was really a mission of let's finally in the year 2018, although, you know, people were studying this stuff in 1618, really look at this again with a, you know, a 21st century toolkit about how we could reawaken or leverage some of this knowledge for, you know, human health. And then that's where things got interesting because, as complex as it is, it's really much more complex than we could ever imagine.
Than we know, right?
Yeah.
So do you have a product or two? I mean, how do you maintain the company? Because I only see you playing. I really only see you playing. So I know you must be doing serious stuff too.
Yeah, no, obviously we're a biotech company at heart. I mean, biotech is, you know, one of these industries where they say if you're not raising money, you're not doing your job, especially as a CEO. So, you know, we have investors, the private investors that are more traditional biotech-oriented folks. At the same time, we have some activity going on in the in sort of the non-pharmaceutical area in terms of consumer healthcare and so forth. Those are the two sort of pillars of the traditional business, let's say. It's all about playing at the end of the day. And yes, you have to accept, you know, the fact that a lot of what you're doing in this business or in this field in general is playing, because it's just, you know, I joke with people that ask me, you know, should I get involved in biotech? And so I say to myself, if you can deal with failure, if you deal with thousands of failures and still be happy and come to work every day and play in the lab and realize that, you know, things are not always going to go your way because biology is not about, you know, it's not like an app on your cell phone. It's a little different. So, if you can deal with failure and rejection and so forth thousands of times in a row, sure. Hey, let's do this. And yes, I play a lot. play a lot getting things right. We're trying.
I think it was in Edison's laboratory when he watched him try something that failed, said, "Oh, it failed." Edison said, "Oh, no, I just found another thing that doesn't work. I'm that much closer to finding out what does."
Right. So the light bulb.
Right.
The light bulb was an invention with 1,000 steps, yes.
and so it seems to me that a genuine scientist is really someone who plays on the edges of what's known so he can find the next frontier, and that's what I love watching you do. Now, let me ask you a big question. What is consciousness from your point of view? How would you define consciousness?
Oh, thanks. Thank you for giving me that one.
We're starting with the easy questions, right? No, I mean, there's no right answer to this because I don't think anyone definitively knows. I think we're at a place where we're trying to better understand it. I have a definition, but it probably would not agree with yours. But doesn't matter. We're all looking at a huge reality from all different angles and really little pieces of it. But do you have any working definition?
I have the basic definitions. So, you know, the obvious textbook stuff of, you know, a state of you know, awareness or being aware of yourself or oneself from a, you know, a what is it in terms of a tangible thing. We are, and I know you know, smack me down and say, no, you're not right, but that's fine. I don't mind that at all. But, you know, we sit here and our current thinking sort of as we work in the central nervous system regeneration stuff is all about a interesting electromagnetic field of information and possibilities that is existing in the present, in the past, in the future, in all aspects of space-time, which we tap into, and which in many ways is still quite beyond our understanding to
yes.
adequately describe it, and it is still a, in quote, hard problem.
So, yes.
That's what I'll go with it.
I would say that the reason it's a hard problem is that scientists are looking at it from the wrong direction. They're assuming it has to be generated by the brain when our information suggests that it's the brain is just a receiver and transmitter of what consciousness actually is. And that explains, if that's true, it explains some of the things you've been wrestling with that we're going to talk about in the next segment. So my definition, and this is the best, I didn't make this up, but this is the best one I found, is that consciousness is an energy-like potentiality without size or form, alive in the sense that our minds are alive, highly emotional, and therefore probably self-aware. I don't know if that's any more true than what you just said. But
you know, I would agree with everything you said, and we are completely in agreement with you.
We come at all of these issues from totally different directions, and he's trying to be, to have all, he works, he owns a biotech company, he's got to be very traditional, but we tend to agree about everything. I think it's phenomenal. Now, one of the things I'd like to talk about that I know you're interested in is the mind-memories interface. Can you talk about that, Ira?
Sure. I mean, we, you know, one of the main pillars of our business or our focus is the central nervous system, and we're very interested from a therapeutic perspective in central nervous system regeneration, and specifically how all of those wonderful organisms in nature who can lose their brains, literally have them cut out and thrown away only to regenerate entirely.
Good
somehow,
heavens.
Somehow, and this has been known for decades, although one of, you know, another, as you mentioned, I mean, there's a lot more things that have been swept under the rug than we can count. But the fact that the regenerators, when they get their new brains, somehow know things that were only in the previous brain. And, you know, this is one of those sort of the intrinsic capability of regenerative organisms following this complete central nervous destruction to remember stuff, which, you know, if you believe that we're just what's in the skull, you know, violates. Pretty straightforward.
Absolutely. Big time. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And so, go ahead.
Well, so I was just going to say, but if, in fact, this energy-like potentiality is really what is consciousness, and you're dealing with conscious beings, then it would make sense that those memories are not stored in the mind in the brain at all. They're stored in the mind, which is not located in the brain. It's sort of like it's the broadcast center some distance away, and the brain is just a receiver and transmitter. That would explain it, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we're clearly in that camp. That believes that, look, if miraculously we were able to take out your brain or my brain and just, you know, store it and keep it alive in a tank of fluid somewhere with some futuristic technologies, that's not Roberta Grimes anymore. That's not Ira Pastor anymore. And that's that. Not to mention, I mean, that's just one aspect. I mean, keep in mind, I mean, there's many organisms out there that, you know, do not have brains, right? They're very happy without them. And we, okay, for the first several weeks of our lives, we didn't have brains, but we did a lot of stuff. Really a lot of complex things. So yeah, there's just from a biologic perspective, yeah, there's just so much, as they say, necessary but not sufficient stuff going on that it makes this just even a bigger question mark in many ways. Or it makes it, as we approach the central nervous system and as we look for interesting methods for regeneration and ultimate reanimation of dead or dying brain tissue, we have to keep in mind and we have to think about it, because that's how you will design, at the end of the day, the appropriate protocol that may work and not, you know, I won't keep hearing from you that I'm wrong.
I try to be polite about it, though. I try to say, gee, I don't think that'll work. This is why. But what I love is the fact that you are always looking at the edges of things. Very few scientists dare to do that. They have this cozy little career. But one of the things that you talk about, too, is that hundreds of thousands of brain cells die each day in the normal brain. And the brain you have and as an adult is all different cells. You've said the general brain turnover. But we remember things from our earliest childhood, and that's kind of that same problem transported to people. How is it possible that we remember things? My earliest memory was probably 3 months old. I remember it vividly. So that being the case, how do we hold on to that as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's another one. Clearly, you know, we grow up, or sort of the more traditional biologic teaching is, you know, okay, yeah, our blood turns over, the epithelial line of our skin turns over, the epithelial line of our gut, but the brain is the brain and the heart is the heart, and these things just don't, we get them, they grow a little bit, and we're stuck with them, and it's just not the case. And it's not just the, you know, the hundreds of thousands of neurons that die every day, but it's the biochemical milieu, within each neuron that cycles tens of thousands of times in a lifetime of that cell. So it's, yeah, I mean, we go through many brains technically in a lifetime, and we go through an infinite array of neurons, and you know, you can go deeper and deeper in a reductionist context as they're doing. But you're not going to find – you can go deeper and deeper. You're not going to find what you're looking for at that deep level. There's a bigger thing going on here.
So explain reductionist, because people listening may not be familiar with that term as scientists use it.
Or as you
use it talking about scientists, maybe,
yeah,
that's better.
Reductionism is sort of the basic belief that – you dig deeper and deeper into the finer components of a system, whether they, you know, 500 years ago, we studied organisms. Then we learned about organs, 100 years ago. Then we learned about cells. Then we learned about DNA. And at each level, we kept going deeper and deeper, trying to find the answers, but we would throw away the systems teaching that came before. And so as an example, here we are, this is one example of the big problem in my industry. We've gotten down to the level of the genes, yet genes don't do anything, right?
I mean,
they're just carriers of information. They get their
proteins,
signal.
Right? That's all they do is code for proteins, really?
Yeah, but by themselves, they can't even do that, right? They have to get a biokinetic, topokinetic signaling from everything above it. They get signals from cells. The cells take their messages from the organ dynamics. Those take messages from the viscoelastic differences in the hydrodynamic fluids of the body. So there's a system here, and if we throw away what comes before, as we continually have done, we learn nothing.
Yes, I can see that.
We just get deeper and deeper into a hole, and this is a big problem. In some areas, we begin to see a reconnection. For instance, electricity and magnetism, which were, you know, if you and I went in a time machine right now and we traveled back 100 years to a biology lab, that was what everyone was talking about back then, because we didn't know about genes and we didn't know about subnuclear components. And we talked about fields and forces and waves and all these interesting sort of turn of the 20th century terms we find in physics. We threw them away. And now what are we finding out? Well, we're finding out finally in 2018 that, yes, there's bioelectric fields surrounding every one of our organs. There's biomagnetic resonance that's occurring between strands of DNA. And for anyone to think that in a 50 trillion cell being like you and me, with hundreds of thousands of chemical reactions in each cell occurring every day, that it's all, oops, you know, it's randomly occurring,
right,
is the greatest reductionist, you know, fiasco of them all.
Wow, what a great explanation. Thank you for that. Yeah, I mean, essentially, looking at it as a layperson, we have to accept the fact that scientists, although they talk a good game, as you say, Ira, they sweep a lot of stuff under the rug, they really haven't made any material progress for a century. We've made technological progress. We've got computers now. But when it comes to basic research and basic discoveries, they're coming up empty. And that's a very good reason why. This is much more complex than they've given it credit for. But one of the things I want to talk about is what you talk about is the brain-centric phenomena model does not address things like terminal lucidity and all kinds of other little things that happen routinely that there's just no way to explain if consciousness is generated by the brain. Can you talk about that? And we'll start now and then we'll go into the next segment with it.
Sure. So the connectome-centric model that is in essence says that you, I, everyone listening, is just the few pounds of goo inside the skull. if that's all you believe, and if it's comforting to people, it does not explain a range of quite well-documented phenomena in the literature. Terminal lucidity, as you bring up in Alzheimer's patients, a well-documented condition whereby Alzheimer's patients who are ravaged by the disease for decades, who do not know their wife's name, who forget right. Who their children are, somehow, at the moment of their death, become completely lucid and remember everything, is unexplainable. You can't explain it with the connectome-centric
right.
model. Gain-in-function events. So everyone's quite well familiar with induced savant syndrome, Rain Man-type situations where, you know, the construction worker who dropped out of school in the eighth grade and gets hit on the head one day at work and can somehow play Mozart the next, even though they never had any music training, is
yes.
not explained by a connectome-centric model. And
right.
And lastly, you have many cases of so-called hydrocephalic children, children that are born without a cortex. Which is where
it's filled by fluid. That's why it's
right.
it's has that term, right? But there's
yeah.
really no brain there. Very little, just a little
yeah.
skin of it.
There's nothing there. There's a brain stem, of course, but these children are conscious. That's a big oops in terms of the
yes.
connectome-centric model. You know, where is that mind? Why it's not the brain's not there? Where is this consciousness coming from? So yeah.
But the people who are doing sort of the cutting-edge consciousness research from the viewpoint of working with people we used to think were dead have a couple of answers to that. One is that the meat brain is really vastly excessive beyond what you would really need to make all the necessary connections to consciousness, which, of course, is outside the brain. And the other thing they would say is actually the connection we tend to think of ourselves as being in our heads. You know, that's where the mind is, that's where everything is. And the reason we think that is that's where our senses are. You know, you have eyes in the front, you have ears on the side, so naturally you must be in there somewhere. But in point of fact, they tell us consciousness connects to the entire body. And when we leave with all of that consciousness. So it's way more complicated than we understand either, but it's certainly more complicated than scientists know. And you also talk about the fact that there are people who know things, even children who are, for example, don't have any kind of an injury or something that would make them into savants, but they learn to play the piano music beautifully right from the time that they first take lessons. I mean, I've heard some of these children. I had grandchildren and grandchildren who took piano lessons, and some of these kids immediately pick it up. They must have learned it somewhere else. But how is that possible if your mind, it just starts when you're first born?
Yeah, it's those cases are fascinating. I mean, obviously, the stuff at the Perceptual Studies Division down at University of Virginia is mind-blowing, to say say the least. No pun intended. But, yeah, three-year-olds that know everything about World War One fighter pilots.
That's another phenomenon. That's right.
Yeah.
That's reincarnation. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. All of this they can't explain. What did they say about those children? The people who have pre-birth memories, what do the scientists say about them?
I don't quite know. I know I've heard things about, you know, genetic memory and cellular memory and things of this nature, but it's beyond that. It's obviously so much beyond that as an explanation, because this is information. It's complex information. And it's complex information separated spatially and temporally by large distances. So, they just didn't, you know, they didn't pick up a book and read everything about some guy from World War One. No, it didn't happen that way either.
No.
So,
they really can't explain any of that. And so why are they holding to a false model? Do you have insights on that?
I'll speak just from sort of my own experience in this particular industry, but I always grew up thinking that sort of at least in the biotech space, it was always about sort of this stairway of sort of scientific enlightenment, that every step we learn something new and we took over that. But it's so much different. It's this evolutionary tree where, you know, most branches die off and only a few, and not the most, you know, obviously not the truthful ones, sometimes flourish. And that could be because of things going out of vogue or non-patentability or financing or whatever. But there's a lot of reasons why things get swept away and ignored. And a lot of it is, on the other hand, is just the as the further most of us, and not, I'll step away from this myself, but the further most of us get away from sort of the childish thinking, the enthusiasm for the miraculous and other possibilities, we blind ourselves to much more.
And yes.
I'm not willing to blind myself to, as Einstein says, I am willing to stand in awe of the miraculous still.
What a beautiful thing that is to say. I'm willing to stand in awe of the miraculous and then figure out how it happens, which is the most important part. All right, so one of the things that I know you've been doing is making some attempts to reanimate dead bodies. I mean, you had to go to other countries even. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is a project of ours. It was generated based on a little carpet sweeping, actually, because even though we have defined brain death, which is the primary definition of death in most countries around the world nowadays, as this irreversible dynamic, as so defined in 1968 by the Harvard Ad Hoc Brain Death Criteria, if you go into the literature, you will find several dozen reported cases of spontaneous brain death reversal, primarily in young children.
Yes.
These cases are controversial. They're hotly debated. But they show that things are not always black and white with regard to what it means to be alive and what it means to be dead. And they are clearly swept under the rug. Combine that with the fact that, as we mentioned before, there are many organisms, non-human organisms, that regenerate their whole brains in perfect structure and function. And lastly, the area of so-called living cadaver research has gone on legally, morally, ethically in many countries now for decades. So we got to thinking, all right, why can't we use this legitimate model of research that is occurring for other reasons, you know, to test high-dose chemotherapies and all other sorts of things that would normally kill somebody, but use it for something a little more constructive, such as beginning to explore the regeneration of neurons and vasculature in the brainstem of someone who is recently deceased, because that is the reason that we leave this world, the fact that we no longer have independent breathing and heartbeat. So this is, as I said, this is a component of our neuroregeneration program. We are also very interested in all diseases of the central nervous system. But clearly, as there has been zero research dollars dedicated to the so-called severe disorders of consciousness in the last several decades, we felt that it's something that... No one researches coma and persistent vegetative state in any real context. Like,
really? You know, that's too bad.
Cancer or Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah.
So it is an area that we believe deserves some attention. Because we do not claim that tomorrow death will be eliminated. But what we do believe is that if we can understand what it means to transition in that gray zone between deep coma and irreversible coma, we can make some major impact to what it means to be alive and dead at that point of acute damage, and ways that we can potentially reverse it. This is not going to end death by any means today. Clearly, death caused by brain death as a sequelae of incurable chronic diseases, we still have a lot on our plate. But I've clearly stated, and I will back it, that I believe we will probably solve death or the first stages of death well before we as an industry cure cancer, just because death is, in essence, one thing. You know, there's one cascade that occurs at the end of all of our lives. Cancer can be thousands of things. So I think it's a very exciting project. It's early stage still. We haven't made tremendous amounts of progress yet just because of the intricacies in how one recruits a population. But we are slowly but surely moving in these directions.
So some people will agree to be experimented on, or do you have to wait till maybe they're declared brain dead? Or how do you get the chance to experiment with these people?
Right now, it is solely after the fact, or you know, at the point of at the point that we do not have a model like you know, the cryonics business where, you know, people sign up decades in advance. That's not what we're thinking about at this point. But basically, a family may contact us and discuss, you know, they're not interested in organ transplant. They believe in the potential of biomedical science, and you know, many patients every year donate their bodies to medical research. So right now we're just sort of tapping into that existing system. But it is not, no, this is not, we're not recruiting, you know, like if we did a
sign
study.
Up. Right. No. Right. But these people then that you're, who these bodies that you're working with are dead, right? They've been declared dead. There's no heartbeat. There's no breathing. They're none of the body is dead before you start to work on it, right?
Well, no. You just went past the living cadaver definition. So, no, these patients would be...
Cadaver definition. Let's have that one.
Okay.
What is
so,
a living cadaver?
Somebody who has been declared brain dead per the uniform determination of death criteria, but who are still on cardiopulmonary support. So their hearts are beating, their lungs are breathing, and they are trophically being supported, so nutrition, certain hormones. Not to get morose, but you know, when one dies, everything below the brainstem, with the appropriate attention, is very alive. A dead person can do many things.
What we're talking about was zombies, right? Living cadavers. Cadavers that are declared dead, but because they remained on life support, I guess you have to prove that they can't breathe and do things on their own, right? That's part of the
The smart people in the neurointensivist world are pretty good at doing that today, in terms of the brain death definition as it is currently defined.
So, what are you doing with these people then? Just sort of briefly.
The protocol is designed to mimic what we see in nature in terms of the planarians, the amphibians, the other organisms, metamorphic insects, whose brains can, in essence, be destroyed and grow back. So we study, and we've been studying, what's involved in that process, which is basically a recapitulation of brain development from when we were an embryo and a fetus, and how we can mimic that with our existing tools, namely peptides and proteins that guide morphogenesis with regard to stem cells and new materials. And lastly, some of the more device-related tools that are used in the intensive care theater nowadays for stimulating coma and PVS patients. So we call it sort of a combinatorial protocol. There is this is not, as the pharmaceutical industry likes, you know, a single silver magic bullet. There's no little pill that you're going to get at your Rite Aid that can do this. But we're basically studying the system, as we've said, the non-reductionist perspective on what is going on in nature, how nature has created via the forces that be from hundreds of millions of years the ability to regrow a brain and its vasculature, its architecture, and mimic that in humans with our tools. So that is the ultimate goal of what.
Wow. Okay. So that if you could make a new brain in these people, you believe they would live again, right?
I believe if we could just, you know, reconnect some of the neurons and vasculature in the brainstem, we transition them from a state of death back to a state of life, and then we work upwards. So it's not about, you know, a new brain instantly appearing a la the zombie movies, but yeah. It's a slow progression up that chain of, in essence, how when you and I were in our mother's wombs, a brain formed in the first place.
That's what we're interested in. Okay, well, see, now let's look at that from the viewpoint of afterlife researchers. What we are told by the people we used to think were dead is that what the Bible calls a silver cord, and what actually is visible when people are out of their bodies, which we are frequently out of our bodies, we're connected to the body by this, you know, sort of glowing, faintly visible cord, and which is infinitely stretchy. You can go to the end of the universe and the cord stays intact while your body is alive. But we're told that when we come to a naturally planned, pre-planned exit point from this life, that cord will break and that there's no way to reattach it. That's what they say. So what I find is interesting is maybe we'll be able to test that, or to find out whether, if there is a potential for this all to happen, maybe the process will change and there will be the potential to reconnect, or maybe part of the cord will stay there or something. I'm just fascinated by the fact that we're both dancing along the same edge, you from the physical side and me from the, I won't even call it spiritual side, sort of from the mind side. And I think it's fascinating that this is even something that you're doing. Are you devoting much money to this, or have you gotten some grants?
Yeah, this is all internal money right now from our existing investors. You know, we are, as you mentioned, we're not contemplating this right now in the United States, just because intensive care costs here are upwards of $15,000 a day. So that's why we are, you know, in discussion in other countries around the world where living cadaver research is also relevant. But yeah, it's, as I said, it's not our core project in the central nervous system. You know, we also focused on Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and spinal cord injury, but it is something that we are not going to ignore because it is, in our opinion, realistic.
Now, is there anything you particularly want our listeners to know? I mean, these are people who are very interested in understanding reality in the broadest sense. Some of them are interested primarily in, you know, life after death, but many of the people I hear from just find understanding how it all fits together to be very important. Is there anything particular you'd like them to know?
Well, you know, as I said before, we are very appreciative of the grander architecture behind what controls all of this. And as, you know, we leave our bodies now, and we, in the only recent years, when you see the study of how the grander cosmic forces of this universe, whether they are solar cycles or lunar cycles or gravity or even time itself. And, you know, this look at this evolving area of chronobiology and how, you know, you and I are quite different at 11 o'clock in the morning than we are at 5 in the afternoon.
Wow, that's right.
We appreciate the grand scale. At the same time, we appreciate the, let's say, the micro. The fact that there are only, you know, what is it, 10 to the 23rd powers of largeness in this universe, so the physicists say, but we have 10 to the negative, I think it's 36 powers of smallness and inner space, which we've only begun to explore. I mean, you could stick a whole universe within the microcosm. I believe that there is just so much that we can find. And whether it's in the large stuff, or whether it's in the small, we are never going to deviate from the fact that it is an integrated process. We are never going to throw away the largeness and just look at the smallness. But there is so much space there, whether it is outer, inner, or extra dimensional,
extra.
That
yes.
we believe holds answers. And that's where our thinking is today.
So if you're Ira Pastor, you get to play for your entire life. I mean, I envy you. Very few people do I envy, but I envy you your life, because you really are playing still. And in playing, you're likely to – I mean, that's what the greatest scientists always have done. I mean, Einstein was playful, and just everyone, that because – if you're not willing to play, you really can't have the insights, it seems to me, that will make things really happen. So I'm thrilled to know you. I'm anxious to keep watching your progress. How would people reach you, and what is your website?
It's just the BioQuark, BioQuark.com. Please come to the website. You can read all about what we have going on. We're a pretty open book. And reach out. We love to talk about what we do. And are proud of it. We see ourselves as, you know, I'm saying we're just pioneers, but we are clearly proud of the fact that we are willing to push the boundaries, and not just the boundaries of the science, but the boundaries in sort of the scientific discipline, and how one, once again, you know, takes off the blinders and is willing to bring the miraculous into the lab.
Bring the miraculous into the lab. You know, may we all feel the way you feel, which is that we stand awestruck before the miracles, because frankly, everything is a miracle. And we don't understand that, we really aren't doing science at all. Big hug, Ira. You and I will be talking again soon.
I'll give you a big hug too.
Everyone, we've been talking with Ira Pastor, who is, I think, one of the most interesting people I've ever met. This has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes, and I'm so glad you could join us today. Please never forget that you are a powerful, eternal being. You never began, you never will end. And when you really understand all the implications of that, it is going to change everything in your life for the better. Next week, our guest will again be your host. We'll be following up on our conversation of last week, when I told you the story of my life and why it was that I became obsessed with studying the afterlife, and I ended up doing it for 50 years. Doing all that work has given me a really wonderful life. Not only did I find confirmation and details of a far more glorious, greater reality than I ever could have imagined when I started, but now, when I really probably should be in a rocking chair, I am actually busier than I ever have been in my life. And I get to spend all day, every day, teaching and helping other people to leave their fears behind forever and to live in the joyful knowledge that human life really is, we can prove it, really is eternal. And now, amazingly, it turns out that I, even beyond all of that, what I think of as a perfect lifetime of work, even beyond all of that, there's an extraordinary new beginning for me that looks now to be even more glorious. And I'm going to talk about that next week. So please join me. This week, our guest has been Ira Pastor, who is the visionary CEO of BioQuark. BioQuark is a biotech company that is unafraid to follow the truth wherever it leads. Wow, is that different and unusual? If great discoveries are ever going to be made about human consciousness, about the persistence of the human mind, about how death can be reversed, or really about anything important to any of us that has the power to transform human life for the better, it's going to be open-minded researchers like my dear friend Ira Pastor who will make those discoveries. BioQuark is blazing a trail to the future, and of course, BioQuark, Inc. Go there for more information. As you know, my own nonfiction books are Liberating Jesus, My Thomas, The Fun of Dying, The Fun of Staying in Touch, The Fun of Growing Forever, The Fun of Living Together, and for young children, The Fun of Meeting Jesus. You can order my books through bookstores or on Amazon.com, and they're also available as audiobooks, except, of course, the children's book. If you want to talk about any of my books or if you want to talk about anything at all, you can contact me through RobertaGrimes.com. I answer emails. Just please be sure to give me your correct email address so I can answer you. Meanwhile, this has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Please enjoy, please make the most of this coming week in Hour One Reality. Please always know that you are a powerful eternal being, and you in particular are infinitely loved.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.